Today, I want to talk to you about the location where the single most important event in all of world history transpired. I'm talking, of course, about the resurrection of Christ, which means not merely that he came back from the dead, but that he came back in a glorified, immortal body, never again to get sick, never again to know weakness and disease, never again to die. I want to talk about that location where that happened. Now, in that regard, this is not going to be so much of a sermon, but more of a Bible lesson. Not so much devotional, but more informational in tone. But I hope it's information that you'll find interesting. More importantly, I hope it's information that will really help you get a fuller understanding of the biblical narrative. When you go back and read the accounts of the resurrection of Christ, I hope you'll bring so much more understanding to the text after you've heard the discussion this morning. Now, I said I want to talk about the location where Christ rose from the dead. Actually, among historians and scholars, there is not agreement on this, because there are actually two options, two different locations where scholars think Christ might have been buried and hence from which he rose from the dead. Now, the original location, the most common and, you know, traditional identification, is at the Church of the Holy Sepulcher. Let me show you a picture of a map of ancient Jerusalem. You see there a blue dot that represents the location of the Church of the Holy Sepulcher, which is built over a tomb, several other tombs in that area. But this is believed to be the very tomb in which Christ was buried and hence from which he rose from the dead. You see this blue dot is kind of in the northwestern corner of the ancient city of Jerusalem, to the west of the Temple Mount. Now, the reason that this is the traditional site of the burial of Christ is that in the 300s A.D., when the mother of the Roman Emperor Constantine converted to Christianity, she went to the city of Jerusalem looking for relics and holy sites. She claimed to have found, for example, remnants of the actual cross on which Christ had been crucified 300 years earlier. And she began to identify holy sites. And one of them was the place where she believed Christ had been buried. Now, time won't permit me to get into all the reasons as to why she chose that particular location, but she chose that spot, and then a church was built there, the Church of the Holy Sepulcher. And so for the last 1,700 years, they say that's where Christ rose from the dead. But I say there is another option, another possibility. So let me talk a little bit about this other possibility. It was unknown for most of the last 2,000 years. Indeed, this site was not known until the late 1800s, when a fellow who owned this particular plot of land decided to dig a well. So he started digging a hole down. As he began to dig down, he came across a large cavern or hole or something like that under the ground, thought he might have discovered something significant. So he called in some experts, some archaeologists, and they began to dig around there, and they said, "This isn't a hole, this isn't a cavern, you've uncovered an ancient tomb. This is a sepulcher." See, what had happened is over the process of hundreds of years, so much dirt and fill had been layered up in that location, it literally had buried the whole site. The entire tomb was underground. And so they dug it all up. And the more they began to study and examine this tomb, they said, "You know, I think this could actually be the right tomb. This could actually be the real location where Christ had been buried." And so since the 1800s, that has been the alternative option. So let me show you where this tomb is located. Again, it is represented on this ancient map of Jerusalem by a blue dot. You'll see it's up there to the north of the ancient walls of the city of Jerusalem. And this location is referred to as the Garden Tomb. Now, I believe that the Garden Tomb is the right choice. That's the traditional site there at the Church of the Holy Sepulcher is wrong, and instead he was actually buried in the Garden Tomb. And I want to give you my reasons for that. And along the way, I hope, as I said, you'll gain a greater understanding of the biblical story of the resurrection of Christ. So why do I believe it's actually the Garden Tomb, and why does that matter? Well, I want to talk about three things that we know about the Garden Tomb. I want to talk about its location. I want to talk about some of its interior features. And then I want to talk about the exterior features. Let's begin by talking about its location. Again, you're looking at its location there on the map. And that location, I think, is relevant, because this location would suggest to us that this is a tomb that's close to the probable site where Christ was actually crucified. You remember Christ was crucified at Mount Calvary. In the original language, you call it Golgotha. You may recall that Golgotha is actually literally translated as the place of a skull. And so the tomb is very close to the probable location of Christ's crucifixion. Now that's significant because of what John tells us in John chapter 19, verses 41 and 42. The Apostle John says, "Now in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden. And in the garden, a new sepulchre, wherein was never man laid. There they laid Jesus, therefore, because of the Jews' preparation day, for the sepulchre was nigh at hand." So talking about the cross, they say they took the body of Jesus down from the cross, and they buried it in the tomb that was nigh at hand. So the tomb is very close to the crucifixion site. Likewise, John says here that literally the tomb was in the same place. So the tomb has to be very close to the site of the crucifixion. Well, in that regard, the probable site of the crucifixion is literally just around the corner from where that ancient tomb was. Now, when I say that it is the probable site of the crucifixion, again, at the traditional site, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, there is a hill, but there's no reason to think that this is Golgotha. There's no reason whatsoever to associate that hill at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre with a skull. Whereas at this other location that is a more likely candidate for the place where Christ was crucified, we can clearly see why it would have been called the place of the skull. First of all, let me show you a picture that I took of this location when I was in Jerusalem. You're looking at the hillside of what I believe is Golgotha. And if you look to the right side of the picture, you can make out a couple holes that look like eye sockets and what would be the nose of a skull. Let me zoom in a little bit and you can see that perhaps a little better. Here's a close-up. And looking at the close-up, I think you can see what would represent the two eye sockets and the nose. So it does look eerily like a skull. And it wasn't, again, not until the late 1800s that a fellow was there at that location got to looking at the side of the cliff and said, you know, that kind of looks like a skull. I think maybe this was the location of the crucifixion. And so they began to put two and two together. Now, in this regard, there is another strategic reason why this might be the best choice for the location of Golgotha. And that is, this was a likely location where they would do executions. They would take somebody out of the city and there execute them. This is an ancient Jewish and Christian tradition. For example, it is quite possibly that this is the very location where Stephen was stoned. And since it was a place where they would do public executions, it would naturally be known as the place of the skull. A skull calls to mind the concept of death. So there are two reasons why this is the more likely place of the crucifixion. Because that hillside literally looks like a skull, and because we know there is an ancient tradition that says this was a place where they would execute people. And so, the likely location for the crucifixion. And if that's where the crucifixion happened, then that tomb is right by it. It's got to be the right tomb. Now, there's a second observation we can make from looking at the map. And as you will note, that blue dot representing the location of the crucifixion is on the north side of the city. On the north side. Now, why is that significant? Well, because of a statement we find in the book of Leviticus. Look with me, if you would, at Leviticus chapter 1, verses 10 through 11. That's Leviticus chapter 1, verses 10 through 11, where Moses is giving the regulations about offering up sacrifices. What do you do with that lamb when you come to offer him as a sacrifice? Well, Moses says, "And if the offering be one of the flock, namely of the sheep or of the goats for a burnt sacrifice, excuse me, he shall bring it a male without blemish. And he shall kill it on the side of the altar," note this, "northward before the Lord. And the priest, Aaron's son, shall sprinkle its blood round about upon the altar." So when they were to kill a sacrificial animal, they were to slaughter on the north side of the altar. This may well be a suggestion that Christ himself would be offered as a sacrifice on the north side of Jerusalem. And that's exactly where this suggestion is for the crucifixion site and the nearby tomb. Yet another observation is, again, this site is outside of the city walls. Again, if you look at the map, the red line on this map represents the northernmost walls of ancient Jerusalem in the time of Jesus. And you'll see the blue dot is outside of the walls there. Well, that's significant because of what we're told in Hebrews chapter 13. Notice Hebrews chapter 13, verses 11 through 12. Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 11 through 12 talks about on the Day of Atonement what would happen to the sacrificial animal's body. And then he talks about how that pictured Christ. And so here's what he says. Hebrews chapter 13, verse 11 through 12. He says, "For the bodies of those beasts, whose blood is brought into the sanctuary by the high priest for sin, are burned without the camp. Wherefore Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people with his own blood, suffered without the gate." So we know the crucifixion site has to be outside of the walls and outside of the gate that he references. Not coincidentally, this suggestion for the tomb and the cross is about 200 yards from a major gate location, the Damascus Gate. And it's called the Damascus Gate because there's a major road that comes out of that gate and goes northward toward toward Damascus. And there's also a road that heads eastward there, and so it's actually a major intersection right there of two roads. And this leads to another interesting observation then. If we take a look back at an actual picture, let me get you, here we go. Here's an actual picture again of the crucifixion site. Again, I'm standing back a little bit further from Golgotha. And as you look at this site, you'll see in the foreground of the picture that there's now a parking lot there with buses in front of Golgotha. And just behind the buses, there's a little alleyway that runs between the parking lot and the cliff. Now, most people picture Christ as having been crucified on top of the hill. So they picture three crosses at the top of the hill. But that's probably not where he was crucified. Not on top of the hill, but literally right in front of the hill where that alleyway runs across. That is, again, because this would be an intersection of two roads. And it was usually the Roman custom not to crucify people on top of the hill, but right alongside the road so that all the passersby, everyone walking along the road, would be walking right by the foot of the cross. They look right up and they see this crucifixion victim. So probably not on the top of the hill, but down at the foot of the hill. And what is interesting, or perhaps somewhat sad, what shocked me when I was in Jerusalem viewing this site is I observed that that alleyway today is just filled with trash and garbage. And isn't it ironic that the very site where our Lord was crucified is just treated as so common, and indeed just a lot of trash and litter is there. So this all would fit the description of the biblical data about where Christ was crucified and its proximity to the tomb. But this is a real problem for the suggestion that he was actually crucified and buried at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Well, why? Well, again, you see the blue dot representing the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and you'll notice that it lies within where we believe the ancient city walls ran. Well, that would run contrary to the scriptures. He wasn't crucified inside the city, but outside of the city walls, not far from a major gate. Now, of course, historians and scholars realize that is a problem for the traditional site. And so they make the observation, well, we know how far the northern wall went, but we don't know that the northern wall ran east to west that far north. Maybe only a little part of it went that far north. So they suggest, instead of it looking like what you're seeing on the screen now, an alternative view of the wall, where it runs north up to the point that we know it had reached, and then only runs a little distance east to west, and then it turns and heads back south again. So it kind of has a U shape, or the shape of a horseshoe. And by doing that, we can just get the Church of the Holy Sepulchre outside of the proposed wall. Now the problem with that, several problems with it. First of all, there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that that wall had a U shape to it. They suggest that only because it's an inconvenience to the traditional site. But it's not really a very logical way for the wall to have been built. One key reason, for example, is that in the ancient world, the biggest military threat to the city of Jerusalem always came from the north and northwest. The other sides of the city were protected by valleys. But there was high ground to the north and the northwest. They had to encompass that and then put up walls to protect themselves. right at the location where the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is, you begin rising up to high ground. You wouldn't put the wall at the foot of the high ground because an enemy attacking would have the benefit of the high ground looking down over the wall. Instead, you would put the wall over that and encompass the high ground behind the wall. So it really just doesn't make sense to do the walls like that. So again, the Garden Tomb is at a much better location. It is near the probable crucifixion site. It clearly is unquestionably outside of where the ancient walls were. All right, so those are some suggestions about the tomb and its relationship to the cross. Now I want to talk about something else that we know about this ancient tomb. John chapter 19, verse 41 also tells us that the tomb where Christ was buried was located in a garden. Now, let me talk a little bit about the concept of a garden. Today, when we hear the word garden, we're thinking of something like flowers or maybe vegetables. But the term translated as garden in the Bible would include any number of cultivated plants, not just flowers, not just vegetables, but things such as, for example, an olive grove. You will recall, for example, that Jesus often prayed and, in fact, was arrested at the Garden of Gethsemane. The Garden of Gethsemane wasn't a flower garden. It was an olive grove. We share with you a photo that I took of Gethsemane. You're seeing here on the screen pictures of these large ancient olive trees. They're literally hundreds of years old. So that's an olive grove. And yet it's called the Garden of Gethsemane. Well, in a similar fashion then, at the location where the tomb is, it was called a garden, but when the archaeologists dug up all their dirt and dug up this area, they found there had been an ancient garden there. Not a flower garden, but a wine press. Grapes were cultivated there. And one of the signs that this was a vineyard was the fact that they uncovered a wine press. And you're now seeing a picture of that on the screen. This, again, is a picture of the wine press that I took that is literally just a few feet from the entrance to the tomb. It's just a very short walk from the tomb to this wine press that dates to the first century. And so it was a garden in the sense that there was a vineyard there. Now, by contrast, at the location of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, well, there was no garden. There could not have been a garden there. And we know that because in the first century, that area had been a rock quarry. They had quarried down there, and so all the surface dirt and soil would have long since been removed, and they were digging down and quarrying rocks out of that area. And in that rocky area, yes, some tombs had been dug. But there would have been no topsoil, no dirt to plant any kind of plants or grow anything in. So it doesn't even make sense to suggest that there could have been a garden there where the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is. But by contrast, we know that the Garden Tomb indeed had a garden there. Now, a couple things we know about this whole piece of real estate. First of all, that tomb clearly was owned by a wealthy man because it was large and it was carved out of solid rock. In the first century, the average poor Jew could not afford a fancy tomb carved out of solid rock. That was a very expensive proposition to make something like that. So whoever owned that tomb was a wealthy man. Now, that's all part of that same land complex where the garden was. And again, whoever owned that garden was a wealthy man. He was a businessman. He was in the business of, making the grape juice and wine with the vineyard there. And this was a big operation. One of the telltale signs of this is that the archaeologists uncovered underground a massive water cistern that he had built there to collect water during the rainy season. And then during the off season, you could still provide water for the vineyard from all that water he stored up. So, whoever owned this land was a wealthy man. Well, that's significant because of what the Gospel of Matthew tells us. In Matthew chapter 27, notice what Matthew tells us, again, in association with the burial of Christ. Matthew 27, verses 57 through 60. Matthew 27, 57 through 60, we're told, "And when the evening was come, there came a rich man of Arimathea named Joseph, who also himself was Jesus' disciple. He went to Pilate and begged the body of Jesus. Then Pilate commanded the body to be delivered. And when Joseph had taken the body, he wrapped it in a clean linen cloth and laid it in his own new tomb, which he had hewn out in the rock. And he rolled a great stone to the door of the sepulchre and departed." So we know Jesus was buried in a borrowed tomb. The tomb belonged to a man named Joseph of Arimathea. And Joseph, the Bible stresses, was a very wealthy man. And so when we talk about the location of the tomb, everything just seems to fit with the garden tomb. It matches all the biblical data that we know of. But now, let me turn your attention to the interior features of the tomb. And what data do we know about the tomb and what information we have in the Bible? Well, let me begin by turning your attention to Mark chapter 16 and verse 5. I want you to notice what Mark tells us. A very important statement. But if you read too quickly, you might pass through and not recognize that there's any significance at all to this statement. I want you to notice what Mark says in Mark chapter 16, verse 5. He says, "And entering into the sepulchre, they saw a young man sitting on the right side, clothed in a long white garment, and they were affrighted." So they entered into the tomb, and there on the right side was a man sitting. Now that man actually would have been an angel sitting there that they see. But Mark tells us he was on the right side. Now why is that significant? Well, I want to show you, again here, a picture of two different styles in which tombs in the ancient world were built. There is the way they did it in the old days in the Old Testament era, and then there is the way that they did it in the first century, that is, the New Testament era. On the left side, you see a picture of what a typical Old Testament era tomb looked like. This would consist of two rooms. You enter into the tomb, and the first room you're standing in would be called the weeping chamber. It's the place where they would stand and mourn and grieve over the departed. To the right side, beside it, is the burial chamber. And this is basically an open floor plan from one room to the other. It just kind of flows right in. There's a small wall no higher than knee-high. That runs between the two rooms, but then even there an opening where you can walk in. And so the two rooms are basically side by side, and then you've got burial spaces around the sides of the room to the right side. Now that's how tombs were done in the Old Testament era. Now in the New Testament era, the first century, you see illustrated on the right side here what they typically look like. You would enter the tomb and there'd be the weeping chamber, but then rather than to the side, it would be directly behind the weeping chamber that you would actually find the burial chamber. So here is interesting. Since Christ lived in the first century, you would expect his tomb to look like the picture on the right. That's the way they were always done. Yet Mark explicitly says this was not a typical tomb. It wasn't done the way tombs were usually done in the first century. Instead, Jesus' tomb was done the old-fashioned way, the way they did back in the Old Testament days. So Joseph of Arimathea must have been an old-fashioned guy. He liked the way the old-fashioned tombs were done near where he owned his property and did his tomb. There were some older tombs from the Old Testament era that were done that way. Maybe he just kind of wanted to match the look of the area, or maybe he just was old-fashioned, went into the old-fashioned way. For whatever reason, this tomb was done in the Old Testament style. But this is one of the reasons why some scholars say, well, this can't be the tomb of Jesus, because in the New Testament era, the room should have been behind the weeping chamber. And say, well, yeah, but the Bible explicitly says it wasn't. And so this really could be his tomb. Now, there's something else that is an important observation to make in this regard. Look again at this chart. I pointed out how on the left side, the Old Testament style, you've got beds around the three sides. This would be a depression that was carved out of the rock, and then they could lay a Bible, the body. There's one at the top where we believe Jesus' body was laid. There's one on the right side, and then there's one down at the bottom. So like I said, these are beds, and that's how they were typically done in the Old Testament era. But in the New Testament era, in the first century, they changed the style. Rather than carving out the depression in the rock to be like a bed you laid the corpse in, what they began to do instead is they would dig a hole in the side of the wall of the burial chamber. It would be like a cavity or literally a tunnel. It'd be about 5 or 6 feet long, because that's about how long a body is, and maybe a couple feet wide, a couple feet high, just big enough to slide a body into this tunnel. And so this is a picture inside of the burial chamber from the first century you're looking at, and you'll see how these are more like just tunnels dug in the side of the wall, and then if you want, again, you could put a large stone up in front of it and block it off. And so, you look at what it would look like. You look at the picture on the right side. This is this is your typical first century tomb. You go in the weeping chamber, then behind that's the burial chamber, and in the side of the burial chamber, you've got these tunnels dug. And so scholars say, this is what Jesus' tomb should have looked like because he was buried in the first century. But what we know from the Bible, is that Jesus' tomb had the beds instead of the tunnels carved in the side. Now, how do we know that Jesus' tomb used beds instead of tunnels carved in the side? Well, take a look at the Gospel of John. Again, you have to read carefully to pick up the hints. They're just suggestions. But if you're reading carefully, you begin to piece together the significance of what John is telling us. John chapter 20, verse 5, we're told, "And he, stooping down and looking in, saw the linen clothes lying, yet went not in." And so, you've got the apostle running here to the tomb, and he stops at the doorway, and he looks in. And as he looks in, he can see the place where the body had lain. He can see the linen cloth all lying there. He's got a perfect view of everything there. So he looks in the door, and he can see. Now again, continuing on down verses 11 through 12, we find a similar thing with the women when they come to the tomb. John 20, verse 11 through 12, we're told, "But Mary stood without at the sepulchre weeping, and as she wept, she stooped down and looked into the sepulchre, and seeth two angels in white sitting, the one at the head, the other at the feet, where the body of Jesus had lain." So again, she stops short right there at the door, doesn't go in, just looks from the doorway. Now, why is this significant? Well, looking at the chart on the left, the tomb that we believe Jesus was buried in, if you're at the front door, it would be very easy from the door to look and just kind of look off to your right side, and you got a straight view, because again, remember, this is an open floor plan, two rooms side by side, and so you can see right into that side room where Jesus was buried there at the top of the tomb. Now, looking at a sideways angle, you would see a little bit of the other bed immediately to the right. You wouldn't be able to see any of the bed down at the bottom because it would be immediately to your right. But you get a full view of the bed where we think Jesus would have been buried. So that's what's being described here. On the other hand, if Jesus were buried in a typical first century tomb, well, you got the problem pictured on the right. Looking at the right side picture, you see you're standing at the front door. You've got to look into the burial chamber that is behind the weeping chamber, see through the doorway, and then you've got to be able to see off to the side and see into the tunnel that's carved in the wall and see the body in there and the full length of the tunnel to be able to see the grave clothes laid out there. And you've also got to be able to see the angels sitting inside that tunnel. Which, again, is very unlikely because, as I said, the tunnels aren't that wide and high. How do you have an angel sitting up inside the tunnel? They're not going to fit there. So, for two reasons. First of all, it's out of the line of sight. Secondly, not likely that these angels are going to be sitting inside of a tunnel. Much more likely that the scenario you have is the one pictured on the left. The garden tomb was done in the Old Testament style. And hence, they could clearly see Jesus and the angels. And so again, if you're looking for a typical tomb, then the garden tomb wouldn't be it. But the Gospels are telling us it's not a typical first century tomb. Everything about Jesus seems to be unusual and atypical, right? There are some other interesting observations, though, we can make about the interior of the tomb. I'm showing on the screen now, again, a shot of the depressed area, the bed where Jesus' body would have been laid. You can see where his head would have gone. There's a little bit of a stone pillow there. And then where his feet would have been. Now around the top of that, you see there's like a stone ledge that goes around the depressed area. That stone ledge is deep enough that you could sit on it. You could utilize it like a bench. And so easily we could have had an angel sitting at his feet and an angel sitting at his head. But I want you to look where the feet are. And if you look closely at this picture where the feet are, You can tell that actually it's been carved out a little more to make a little more room for the feet. Now, why is that significant? Well, what that is telling us is that apparently, whoever was buried in this tomb was not the person that this tomb was originally designed for. Whoever was, this tomb was designed for was shorter. If they ended up burying somebody else in there, and his body wouldn't fit. He was too tall. So they had to quickly carve out a little bit of extra space so that he could fit. looking at that space, by the way, we know that whoever was buried there would have been about 5'10", 5'11". That's a little taller than the average man was back in the first century. So Jesus probably was a little taller than the average man. Not a giant, but a little bit taller, since they had to carve out space for his feet. Joseph of Arimathea, probably a little shorter, probably standard height person. Now, as just an aside, an interesting observation comes in with regard to the Shroud of Turin. Now, I'm skeptical about that shroud, but an interesting observation is that the image that is imprinted on that shroud is the image of a man who would have been exactly right about 5'10" to 5'11", the exact height of whoever was buried in that garden tomb. So, that's just interesting as well. And now there's another observation, though, that we can make about this tomb in the interior. And that is, of the three beds that go around the burial chamber, only one of them was completely carved out. The other two were only partially carved, and they never finished carving them out when the tomb was discovered. Just partial. Why would that be? Well, again, John 19:41 tells us that Jesus was buried in a tomb that no one else had ever been buried in. It was a brand new tomb, had not yet been used. So new, apparently, that they didn't quite finish it. And it never was finished. Now, why? Why wouldn't it have been finished? Well, if Jesus had been buried there, you could imagine that afterwards, Joseph of Arimathea wouldn't have chosen to reuse the tomb. And so he just left it like that and never finished it. But if this is not the actual tomb of Jesus, we are left with an intriguing historical question. Whoever owned that tomb, why didn't he finish it? Because remember, this was a very expensive endeavor. It cost a lot of money to build that tomb. You got this close to being entirely done with it, and then you just stop and never finish it. What possible rationale could there be for taking that approach, other than the fact it was probably the tomb in which Jesus was buried, and so Joseph just let it be like that. So those are some interesting observations about the interior of the garden tomb and how they kind of mesh with the biblical data. But now I want to progress with our discussion on to some observations we can make about the exterior of this tomb. So let me show you a picture of the exterior of the tomb. You're looking at, again, from the outside of the tomb, a photo that I took, and you can see the doorway there, and to the right of the doorway, and a little higher, you see another hole in the side wall. Now, between the door and that window, you see some blocks. Those are not an original part of the tomb. That part of the wall had caved in, and so when the archaeologists uncovered it in the 1800s, they kind of rebuilt that part of the wall. So those are modern blocks. But the door is original, and the window was original. And I point out that window because small windows like this in ancient tombs of the first century in the New Testament era were very common. They would put these little windows in the side of the tomb. They called them soul windows. Soul windows. And the Jews had a tradition. They believed that after 3 days of being buried, then the person's soul would leave his body, and they left the window in there so that his soul could escape out that window. And so here's an element of the tomb that is very typical of the first century tombs, but not the Old Testament era. And so, yes, it has some elements of the old-fashioned tombs, but it also has some elements of the first century. So in every way, it's a very unusual tomb. Now, the second thing that I want to draw your attention to is the doorway. So now I'm showing you on the screen a picture that I took there of me standing, of course, in front of the door. And you'll see that my hand is leaning up by the door. And at the location where my hand is actually marking the original height of the door. Later, subsequently, archaeologists can tell somebody came and they expanded the height of the door. They chiseled out a little bit more of it. But originally, it was only as tall as where my hand is. And so you can see it wasn't a very tall doorway. Typically they weren't, and this one was not very tall. And that would mean that to get into the tomb, you have to stoop. As it is, we even with its expanded height, I had to stoop to walk in, but you'd really have to stoop to walk in into this tomb. Well, again, that matches what we had just read in John chapter 20, verse 5 and 11 through 12. We note that Peter had to stoop down to walk into the tomb. Peter and John, when they had got there, had to stoop to, you know, to look in or to walk in. Mary had to stoop to be able to look into the tomb or to be able to walk into that tomb. And so it was with that door. But then there's another feature of this tomb I want to talk about, and that is how the tomb was sealed. Let me turn your attention in this regard, again, back to the Gospel of Matthew, Now, Matthew will tell us what actually all four gospel writers tell us, but we'll use Matthew. Matthew chapter 27, and again, verse 60, says that Joseph of Arimathea laid his body in his own new tomb, which he had hewn out in the rock, and he rolled a great stone to the door of the sepulcher and departed. So the tomb was sealed with this great stone that would have been round and you could roll in front of the doorway. Now, why is that significant? That is significant because in the first century, tombs were not normally sealed with large round stones like that. Instead, again, I'm going to show you a picture of what a typical first century tomb looked like. You see a picture of the tomb here. And actually, the way they would seal the tombs was with a rock that was not round but kind of squarish, or more like a rectangle. And it had a little plug on one part of it that made it look like a cork. And so you put this square rock in front of the tomb, and then you slide it into the tomb, sealing it off like a cork inside of a bottle. That's actually how it was done in the first century. And so again, historians would say, see that garden tomb? It's a pretty spot, but it can't possibly be the tomb in which Jesus was buried, because we know that typically in the first century, they didn't use big round rolling stones, they used square stones like what you see pictured on the screen. In fact, archaeologists have uncovered more than 900 tombs from the first century, and overwhelmingly, almost every single one of them is sealed off with a square stone. Not a round stone. But in the case of the garden tomb, well, again, it is exceptional. Again, I show you a photo that I took at the spot. You see a track that runs along the side of the tomb. It's very obviously the track that was designed for the large rolling stone. The stone would be in there, and this is how they would roll it up and down that track in front of the doorway. So there is no question that the garden tomb was sealed with a stone. Again, that was common in the Old Testament era. Not so common in the first century. But, although usually they were sealed with square stones in the first century, this is not always the case. Out of the 900 odd tombs that archaeologists have uncovered, there are a few exceptions. Four to be precise. Archaeologists know of four tombs from the time of Jesus, all of which were sealed with large round rolling stones. Now, every one of these tombs belonged to very wealthy people. One of them, for example, was the family burial complex for Herod, very wealthy individual, and sealed with a large round stone. Well, again, Joseph of Arimathea was very wealthy. He could have been yet another exception, who chose to use a large round stone like the wealthy people of his day could do. Certainly unusual, but we know for a fact it was sometimes done. So this doesn't rule out the garden tomb as a possibility. To the contrary, this is specifically what the Gospels are telling us. It was a large, round stone, so it's not your typical average run-of-the-mill first century tomb in that regard. And again, historians and scholars will say, well, that Greek word translated as roll can sometimes, in rare context, mean simply to move something, not necessarily to roll. Well, that may be, but again, that's a very rare exception. But that term roll is used repeatedly by all four gospel authors. And the great majority of the time, 99.9% of the time, it means to roll. So you're going to have to argue that four different authors use that term that usually means to roll, and every single one of them were using it with the rare meaning instead of the usual meaning. Just not likely. So it probably means roll. And here is a tomb that would have been sealed with something that you rolled rather than something that you merely pushed or shoved. So the stone is significant as well. And I say it's probably one of the most significant identifying marks of the tomb. If anything would suggest that this is the tomb in which Jesus was buried, it's that fact that it was sealed with a round stone instead of a square stone. But now I want to show you a picture of something else as well. Something else that was found in the exterior of the tomb with remnants of two large metal spikes that had been driven into the sides of the tomb. So I'm showing you a picture that recreates the tomb, and in this recreation you see the large round rolling stone in front of it, a couple Roman soldiers. You see a third Roman soldier who is nailing and inserting this large metal spike into the solid rock there at the side of the stone. There's one on either side of that large stone there. Then the rope is draped across the front of the stone. That rope would have been attached, sealed to the stone with pilots official seal. So if anybody moved or broke that rope or that seal, well, he did so only under the penalty of death. But if you were brave enough to get past the Roman guards, brave enough to break the seal by Pilate, you'd still have to be able to move that stone, only now you can't roll it because the metal spike is right in front of it, blocking it, so it cannot be rolled. So the question then is, how did they roll the stone away? Well, of course, the biblical narrative tells us that a great big angel came down from heaven and rolled the stone away. An angel would have the strength and the force to do that. In this regard, I said there were large metal spikes that had been driven into the wall. But at some point, that metal spike there on the left side had been sheared off, clean sheared off. Only what remains is the part that's in the rock, but there's no part anymore jutting out from the rock. Now, this thing's made out of metal. It would have taken a tremendous amount of force to shear that metal spike right off. Who could have possibly done that? Well, an angel would have had the strength to do that. He just pushed that rock, just pushed it right through that spike and shear it off. And so again, skeptics used to say, well, you know, maybe that's some modern piece of metal that got in there. Maybe it's from the 1967 war. It's a piece of shrapnel that got embedded in the rock wall. They used to say that, for example. So finally, they got a laboratory to test the metal, ruled that out. The character, the components of that metal match exactly what we know of how Romans made metal in the first century. This is clearly first century metal made by the Romans, and so that spike goes to the first century. So again, the Bible doesn't explicitly tell us that the tomb was sealed with a metal spike. We're just making the observation that that's compatible with what we know about the biblical data, how the tomb might have been sealed. And then you got to answer the question, well, how did the stone get rolled away? And who broke that metal spike? Then a final piece of data about the exterior of the tomb that we know, again, doesn't come from the Bible, but it's just a matter of the historical record. When the archaeologists dug up that tomb, they realized that an ancient Byzantine church had been built at that site. There's remnants, the telltale marks, of a Byzantine church at one time stood at that very location. When you go into the tomb, there are the remnants of some graffiti on the wall. Somebody had gone in there and drawn a picture of a cross with the letters Alpha and Omega. Now, why would somebody have drawn that picture on that tomb wall? Why did somebody choose that location to build a chapel, a church? Well, again, we don't know. But the probable suggestion is that somebody built it there because in ancient times they knew this was the location of Christ's tomb, that this was where the resurrection had happened. And so it was a hallowed site, so they built a chapel there that in time was destroyed and buried under the rubble. So those are some interesting details about the exterior of the tomb. So I know I've given you a lot of data, so let's put all this together now and kind of review. We talked first of all about the location of the tomb. Well, it's near what is the most probable location for the crucifixion site, very close to it. Number two, it would be north of Jerusalem in the temple site. Number three, it most definitely was outside the city walls, a couple hundred yards from a major city gate, as Hebrews says it was. Number four, it was definitely located in a garden. An ancient wine press was there. Number five, both the tomb and that garden was all one complex of real estate owned by a very wealthy man who could have been Joseph of Arimathea. Then we talked about the interior features of the tomb. We observed the burial chambers to the right side rather than behind the weeping chamber. Secondly, we note that it used burial beds, these depressions carved into the rock, rather than those tunnels called loculi that were carved into the chamber walls. And this means that the site where Christ was buried was fully visible from the tomb entrance, and that two angels could sit at the head and the feet of where Christ had been buried. Number three, we know that somebody occupied that one bed who was not the originally intended occupant because they had to carve out a little extra space for the feet. He was taller than the original intended occupant. Number four, this tomb was never finished. Somebody invested a lot of money in building it and didn't do that last little bit to complete it. And finally, we talked about the exterior of the tomb. It has a typical sole window, which is typical of New Testament era tombs. The height of the door requires you to stoop to enter, as the gospel said. It was sealed with a massive rolling stone and almost no tombs from the first century war. So that is an outstanding feature of this tomb. There are spikes that could have been used to seal off the tomb so you couldn't roll the stone either direction. And an ancient Byzantine church was built on that very site. Now then, when you look at this garden tomb, in some ways it's like Old Testament tombs, some ways it's like New Testament era tombs. It's unique, which means that anybody could find and locate that tomb. You just say, oh, it's the tomb with the big rolling stone. It's that tomb with the burial chambers to the right side instead of behind. You can't miss it. It's a new tomb, but it's done in the old-fashioned style. So it's simply not possible that the disciples got confused, went to the wrong tomb, didn't find the body, and thought Jesus had risen from the dead. And any subsequent investigators, if they wanted to investigate the site, it's very easy to describe the tomb, that you can't miss it. The one with the big rolling stone. The one with the beds instead of the tunnels carved in the... Can't miss it. See? It was so unique, so unusual, that it was easy to identify. Anybody in the first century could go to the tomb, see it for themselves, and see that it was indeed empty. And, you know, that leads me to the final observation that I want to make this morning about the garden tomb. In this regard, notice what Matthew tells us in chapter 28, verses 5 through 6. Verses 5 through 6, he says, "The angel answered and said unto the women, Fear not ye, for I know that ye seek Jesus, which was crucified. He is not here, for he is risen, as he said. Come, see the place where the Lord lay." You know, the tomb is empty. The garden tomb was empty when it was discovered. No corpse in there. No signs of any corpse. No bones. Now, in the ancient world, Jews would usually come back a year after they had buried the person and the body decomposed, and they would gather up the bones and put it in a little pit, in a bone pit, or they would gather it into a box, a bone box called an ossuary. But there are no bones, no bone box, no remnants, nothing. The tomb was just empty. And that it would be because, of course, Christ rose from the dead. Again, not to die again, like Lazarus or others who were resurrected in the Bible, but with a glorified, immortal body, never again to experience weakness, sickness, mortality, but rather to live forever. And so what happened at that very location is the most important event in all of human history. For the fact that Jesus lives, never again to die, means that you and I can live never again to die. The fact that Jesus' tomb is empty is the guarantee that someday my tomb and your tomb will be empty. Hallelujah. With that thought, have a very blessed and happy Easter.